Today's Teisho will be on case 60 in the P.N. Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 60 is entitled Umon's Staff Becoming a Dragon. Engo's Introduction. Buddhas and sentient beings are not by nature different. Mountains, rivers, and your own self are all just the same. Why should they be separate and constitute two worlds? Even if you are well-versed in Zen koans and know how to deal with them, if you stop there, everything is spoiled. If you do not stop, the whole world will be dissolved, with not a particle of it left behind. Now tell me, what does it mean to be well-versed in Zen koans? See the following. Umon held out his staff and said to the assembled monks, "This staff has transformed itself into a dragon and swallowed up the universe. Where are the mountains, the rivers, and the great world?" Secho's verse, "The staff has blossomed," "the staff has swallowed up the universe." Don't say peach blossoms float on the waters. The fish that gets its tail singed may fail to grasp the mist and clouds. The ones that lie with gills exposed need not lose heart. My verse is done, but do you really hear me? Only be carefree. Stand on wavering. Why so bewildered? 72 blows is not enough. I want to give you 150. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen this morning. Everybody was sitting so well, and it's quite wonderful to practice with all of you. I'm so glad you could make it. Some of you are new to Zen, and some of you are new to our community. This is what's known as a koan, and koans are stories about that usually encapsulate a moment when somebody has an insight into fundamental reality, or as we say, an enlightenment experience. Or they describe an exchange between a student and a teacher prior to that kind of an experience. So in this case, this koan is about a master named Umon, whose name means gate of clouds. And he walks into his zendo, and he holds up a staff, and he says, "This staff," he held out his staff and said to the assembled monks, "This staff has transformed itself into a dragon and swallowed up the universe. Where are the mountains, the rivers, and the great world?" So, you know, if you were sitting there in the rows of the monks and nuns and lay men and lay women who practice Zen, Umon would have come in and held up a staff. And in Zen tradition, it's often the case that Zen teachers hold a ceremonial staff. And if you ever go to China or Japan and you go to a museum, you'll see some of these ceremonial staffs, and they're really beautiful contorted pieces, usually contorted pieces of wood that are sometimes short but usually a little taller than a person. So it's an insignia of a roshi or a teacher's position in the temple, that he would carry this staff. So Umon comes in and he says, "The staff has transformed itself into a dragon and swallowed up the universe." So, you know, if you're sitting there and this guy comes in and he has a staff and he holds it up and he says it's transformed into a dragon and it swallowed up the universe, the question is, what is he talking about? So in what sense can it be said that the staff has turned into a dragon, and then the dragon has swallowed up the universe? How's that possible? Now, you know, one way to solve the problem is to reflect on it or contemplate the koan as an object, as a question. So you could, if you know something about Buddhist philosophy, you might be able to come up with an account or an explanation for why this statement was uttered at that time. So, you know, if you know anything about Indian and Chinese culture, you might know about Huayan tradition, which is part of Zen also. And, you know, Huayan says a speck of rice is as important as the whole universe, and as complex and vast as the whole universe. So, you know, you could go home and read up on Huayan Buddhism, and you could say this koan is an expression of Huayan's influence on Chan, on Zen. And you could say to yourself, yeah, I guess that's true, you know. The staff is the whole universe, if you look at it the right way. But that's just an intellectual understanding. And nothing is, not much is changed by that, by achieving that kind of understanding. If you figure out the koan that way, and it's possible to figure out a lot of koans that way, you know, nothing in your life has really changed. You know, ideas are important. So don't get me wrong. It's important to have good ideas rather than bad ideas. So, for example, our president, I don't know if he actually has any ideas, but if he has any, they're generally bad ones, right? And nobody, I think, on the planet has any confidence in his ability to reason through any issues and come up with better ideas. So you know, basically, it is important to have good ideas. I was just reading that, since we're on the subject of Voldemort, you know, he's apparently driving all the scientists out of the EPA, out of the Environmental Protection Agency. So that seems like a bad idea to me. And it's so important to have the EPA make policy on the basis of good science, not bad science, right? So I want to say that it's important to have good evidence and good facts. I teach writing, and I always make my students quote the text. And I make sure when they quote an author, they actually explain what the passage means. And if they don't get it right, I say, I don't think that's what the author is saying. So I definitely believe that facts have a place. And in fact, it's vitally important that we have good facts. But on the other hand, you know, if you're talking about how you experience the world, you know, facts don't necessarily have a deeply transformative effect. You know, you know, I have spent a lot of my life on the cushion, but I've also spent a lot of my life reading philosophy. You know, and when I was in my when I was about 17 or 18, I read a philosopher named Sartre, and Sartre is an existentialist, and he's a fascinating thinker. And, you know, I read many of his books, and some of them are quite long, and I just thought Sartre had the answer to everything, you know. But, you know, a little later, I read somebody else who was saying something very different from Sartre, and I got into that guy's thinking, and pretty soon if somebody asked me about Sartre, it's like, oh, yeah, he's okay, but this other guy's better. And so you move through life, if you're alive, you know, you move through life reading different people and forming different opinions. Your opinions change, you know. But, you know, actually, whether you read and understand Sartre or not doesn't really make much of a difference in how you live your life day to day. You know, you can read something about, say, how destructive anger is. And, you know, you can read it. There's actually a lot of literature on this, you know, how anger is formed, how what it does to you psychologically. There's a debate about whether people should feel angry or shouldn't feel angry. In fact, even in Buddhism, there's a big debate. A few days ago, I was on a panel, and this issue came up. You know, the Dalai Lama says anger is very bad. Try never to be angry. But one of the people on the panel, who was a Vipassana teacher with a background in psychotherapy, said, you know, actually that's not necessarily good advice. Sometimes people need to express and acknowledge their own anger as a way of getting beyond it. So, you know, the people in the audience could listen to that, but if you have anger issues, you know, just reading something on anger or hearing something about anger in a academic debate doesn't really change much. See, it doesn't really change much. Because you're not really transforming your deeper mental habits. And, you know, people in the West especially put so much emphasis on learning. And that's a good thing, on learning ideas, acquiring ideas. But, ideas are important. It's important to get the right ones, but they aren't as transformative as we think. Just working with the koan in an intellectual sense isn't going to get you very far. You know, you have to work with the koan in a different way, in a much deeper way. It's a little bit like, before anybody, when I was young, and I was a big fan of Sartre. You know, he used to write a lot about death. He actually has an essay. It's something like Being Towards Death. And he says we're alive and we're always knowing, we always know in a certain way that death is coming, and it affects our whole way of living. You know, and so I got into reading about death, and I had many interesting opinions about death. But it was not the same thing as, you know, having my brother get cancer and die. You know, all the books flew out the window, you know. Sartre wasn't much help at that moment. You know, I had to process it at a deeper level than ideas. And ideas weren't any consolation, actually. You know, when somebody has a funeral, you know, people often gather to, you know, for the eulogies, and they'll say he was a great guy, etc., etc. And I'm glad people do that, but you know, it's not really, it's cold comfort, right? It's nice to hear people spoken of, but you know, that loss is something you have to process at a deeper level. It's the same thing with human relationships. You know, when my wife and I got married, we really wanted to be a good couple, you know. So we read all these books, and I remember we once read this book by a person named, it was called The Art of Loving, Fromm's The Art of Loving. And I remember reading that book and trying to follow the advice that Fromm offered, but you know, actually, Erich Fromm is a good philosopher, but you know, it didn't really help me in my relationship with my wife. You know, that required a deeper kind of response from me than just reading, just book knowledge. I couldn't, you know, when I was in some kind of a tangle with my partner in life, I couldn't rush back to the library and look up chapter 6 in Erich Fromm's Art of Loving. You know, there wasn't time, right? And even if, you know, I could say, well, we shouldn't be having this argument because Erich Fromm says, blah, 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 you know. Or I could quote, and now, Barbara, remember what Eric Fromm says, you know. And then I would be strangled to death, right? So you know, it has to come from a deeper place. And so processing the koans comes from a deeper place, you know, not intellectually. We sit down on the cushion, and, you know, if you're just starting to practice Zen, you have to learn to stabilize your mind and enter deep samadhi, deep state of, called meditative absorption. You'll know it when you get there. You know, sometimes you sit down on the cushion and it's hard to get into meditative absorption. You know, you sit down, you have a lot of thoughts, something's eating at you, and you keep coming back to your breath, and it's like a surfer trying to catch a wave, right? You know, sometimes the waves just don't break your way. But sometimes you paddle out and you catch the big wave, and it's the wave of meditative absorption, samadhi. You know, and it can really feel like you're in this deep, it's definitely an altered state of consciousness. It can feel like you're in this deep place. You know, for me, it's like when I was a kid, I used to be on a swimming team, and after we'd work out, we would fool around on the diving board and try to kill ourselves. Fortunately, no one was successful, but, you know, we did our best. And one of the things we would do is get on the highest of the high. There were three levels, and we'd get up. There was no lifeguard, so we'd jump off the highest one. And if you jumped off the highest one, you went down to the bottom of the diving pool. It was probably 18 feet deep. And when you get down to the bottom, that water pressure is really something else. You can really feel it. So, you know, sometimes when I'm in deep samadhi, I feel like I'm at the bottom of that pool, you know, like there's water pressure. And people experience samadhi in many different ways, you know. Some people feel like they're spider webs. Some people feel like their hands or face are disappearing. But when you get into samadhi, you're definitely in a different psychological state. And then, you know, we cultivate empty mind. Wuxin, Muxin. So usually when you can get into deep samadhi rather consistently, you often have it's often a very beautiful experience, and it's not enlightenment, however, so your teacher at that point will usually give you a koan, and in our particular lineage of Zen, we work with the Mu koan, meditation on emptiness. And, you know, emptiness is an idea, word, but also when you are in deep samadhi and you follow your breath out, sometimes you'll notice that your mind becomes blank and empty. And you keep returning to that place, and that place is like the door into your unconscious mind. And ideally, if you're a Zen student, you go to that door, you go to that blankness, and you work on your koan. That's where you do the work of processing your koan. There are real-life koans, too. So, you know, if you lose a brother and you're inconsolable, you can dive deep into the pond and enter into the pool and go to the 18 feet down place, where it's still and quiet and you feel the pressure, and then you can keep watching your breath until you enter a blank state. And when you enter a blank state, there are these powerful feelings of loss or grief, whatever. And, you know, you wait in front of the door to your unconscious for something to happen. And this is the practice of Zen. This is the practice of Zen. You know, when we do this, you know, it can feel challenging, you know, challenging, because, you know, we, especially modern people, don't particularly like to be in a state of uncertainty and powerlessness, right? You know, those are two things most people don't like. You know, I myself dislike them a lot, you know. So, you know, I have been practicing meditation for 40 years. And in most situations, my Zen practice really pays off, you know. So I remember long ago when I just came here to Rutgers, you know, the office I inherited, I run this unit at Rutgers, and my previous, my predecessor was not a gifted administrator. He hardly ever showed up to his office, for example. And so the place was very disorganized, and when I came in, I started to organize it, and there would be like one crisis after another. It's like every day another crisis because they hadn't figured out how to get organized. And one day, my secretary said to me, "How do you stay so calm?" And I had a little smile on my face, you know, because I'd been doing Zen for, at that time, for, you know, 15 years or something. And it was easy to be in this very calm, empty state. But even now, you know, things will throw me, and I don't, you know, I'll find myself stymied, and I don't like it, you know. One thing I particularly don't like is getting lost, you know. So if I'm a few years ago, Barbara and I were driving around in the backwoods of New York State, and it was like every time I took a turn, I got more and more lost, right? We didn't have our GPS, and I kept looking at the map, and the map seemed to bear no resemblance to where we were, and that creates, for me, that kind of situation creates like a lot of anxiety. And, you know, for my wife, that's like, huh, this is an adventure, you know. But, you know, I should have pulled the car over and done some Zazen, you know. She said, "Why are you freaking out about this? You know, it's not like we're in the jungle, you know, it's just just New York State, you know." So it was reassuring, but it's, for some reason it bothers me, right, to be lost like that. And nobody likes to be powerless, right? Nobody likes that. In the modern world, you know, we do value having control over our lives, right? And a lot of our life is, it's actually, most of us have arranged our lives so that we have a great deal of control over our lives. And even though we might not think of it this way, we're generally successful at what we do. You know, so for example, you know, I have an alarm clock, and I actually have two alarm clocks. I have an alarm clock near my bed, and I have an alarm clock at the other side of the room. And, you know, the alarm clock next to my bed is about 5 minutes faster than the one on the other side of the room. So if I set my alarm clock for 5 o'clock, you know, it goes off, I get up, and if I don't get up and I turn that one off, the other one goes on, and then I have to get up, right? And then I go do my Zazen and so on. I have this much time for my Zazen, and I have to get to my office by 9 o'clock. You know, everything, wake up on time, yes. You know, Zazen until such and such a time, yes. You know, get to my office, yes. You know, when I get to my office, I know, you know, usually we have a secretary, she makes coffee, it's this kind of coffee, you know, it's hot, there's milk in the refrigerator, we have a little refrigerator, you know. Then I go, you know, have my class at 9, my first class at 9:50, I have my next class at 1:10, you know, everything's going along, you know. And, you know, if something doesn't work out, you know, it's a problem, right? So basically, we all pretty much live like this, right? We pretty much have highly controlled lives. And it's a good thing, right? If I slept in and didn't get to my class, I would lose my job, you know, or should lose my job anyway, and so on, you know. But having so much control over our lives and being actually so successful at what we do is not necessarily a good thing. That sounds like a strange thing to say. But and I certainly don't want anybody in the room to be unsuccessful in what they're doing, or to seek out opportunities to fail. That's not what Zen is about. But actually, you know, having so much control and being so successful doesn't allow us to expand our horizons or understand who we really are. You know, when I am in the backwoods of upstate New York, freaking out because I don't know where I am, I'm learning a lot more about myself than I am when I'm driving to my office and get there right at 9:30, coffee at 9:40, right? See? So those occasions where things are not going well and I find my anxiety level going up through the ceiling for apparently no reason, see, that's a lot more can be gained from that situation. You know, modern life is almost so smooth and precise that it's difficult for us to wake up. And again, please don't quit your job, you know, don't sleep on the street or anything like that. I'm not saying that. But we definitely need opportunities to fail and opportunities to be stymied and powerless if we want to cultivate wisdom. And life doesn't actually always give us very many of those. I mean, there's definitely occasions where we are thrown for a loop. And those are actually good for us. So, you know, for example, my brother was a very different person than I am. I'm a very left-wing person, and my brother was a very right-wing person. He's not alive anymore. I'd like to think he wouldn't have voted for Trump, you know. I hope, you know. But it was probably possible, right? You know, I could see him saying, "Yeah, I'll hold my nose and vote for Trump." It's like, but you know, so that we had a strange relationship, right? And it was very challenging sometimes because I loved my brother, and I wanted to connect with him. And I think he wanted to connect with me, but we were so, that tension. I learned a lot from that struggle to understand my brother. Much more than if we were, my sister and I are like two peas in a pod, right? So you know, I love her company. But I don't necessarily, I'm not challenged by her in the way my brother used to challenge me. You know, so we can't really learn that much about ourselves just by being so, having so much control and being so successful. And of course, in our lives, we need to have control and we need to be successful, but it's then hard to change ourselves or to understand ourselves more deeply, or become bigger people, you know, become bigger people than we are. It's a conundrum for us, right? We modern people live a very successful life, you know. You might not think of just getting to work and teaching your class on time as a big success, but actually it's success all day long, pretty much. You know, we control things pretty well. But when we do Zen training, this is an opportunity to experience the failure we need and the uncertainty we need to become bigger people and to understand ourselves more profoundly. You know, when I was in school, primarily motivated, for the most part, in high school, by the desire to get good grades so I could get into a good college. And so, you know, I was mostly just interested in the grades. You know, didn't matter, what's the subject? I don't care, just let me get an A, right? And I was just reading an article about how many students have that attitude today. You know, college students too. You know, they're all trying to get into graduate school or get into some professional school of business or something, and all they want are A's. And I meet such students all the time. You know, they're sort of versions of myself in high school. you know, if I don't give them an A, they'll come in to see me and they'll say, you know, I really have to get an A in this class. As a teacher, I find that very funny. You know? It's like, oh, well, why didn't you say so? You know? Coming right up, right? You know? But they want me to know, you know, I must get an A. And, you know, and I'll try to talk to them about what the reading material is. You know, I'll say, well, let's talk, you know, you did get an A on your paper. You know, here's what I think. Let's talk about this, right? And, you know, it's almost like, yeah, yeah, but how do I get the A, you know? And I was like that, too. And this article was saying it's really very, very bad for students. You know, when I got to college, I did sort of branch out. And I remember I got very interested in art history, in art, something that wasn't part of my home when I was growing up. And I started taking art history classes. And, you know, I was a really good English student. You know, I love poetry, I love literature, and I pretty much always got A's in my classes. And I was also an anthropology major, and I pretty much always got A's in anthropology. When I started taking art history, I didn't get A's. In fact, I had to work hard to get B's. And you know what? I took an art history class after my sophomore year. I took at least one art history class every semester, and I never got better than a B. And I never figured out how to get a better grade. But I'm so happy I took those classes. You know, I love to go into museums and look at the paintings, and I'm just totally absorbed. I love the experience, you know. No matter what I did or said, I don't know why. I couldn't ace the class in art history. But I'm so glad I didn't get trapped in that anymore, you know. That happened to me a couple times where I wasn't necessarily good at what I was doing, but I was enjoying the newness of it and learning a new way of thinking about things or experiencing things. Well, you know, Zen practice takes that increases the intensity of that experience, you know. So when your teacher gives you a koan, you know, you want to answer it intellectually. And then, you know, you can't because it's not providing the kind of transformation you need to really work through the koan. And so, you know, you can come in and give your teacher intellectual answers, but that's not going to be an acceptable answer in Zen. The teacher wants to see you going down to the bottom of the pool and entering that blankness and sitting in that blankness. And that's challenging because in this case, you know, the turning word in this koan would be this staff, this staff, this staff. And you sit down on the cushion and you just say staff or this staff. And you know the story, right? The staff turns into a dragon, you know. So you just say this staff, this staff, this staff. And, you know, it for a long time, it feels like nothing is happening. Nothing is happening. But, you know, if you trust the process of Zen, you know, it's something will begin to open up in yourself. Believe it or not, this is the hardest thing for Zen students to trust, right? It takes a long time. You know, we read about the big mind, the deep, active, unconscious mind, but we don't necessarily believe it can do what Zen teachers say it can do. So, you know, you sit in that blankness and you say staff or this staff, just staff, 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 and you think, this is going nowhere, right? And so maybe you go to a sesshin and the teacher gives you staff and you think staff, 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 all day long, staff. Then you get tired, your legs hurt, you're sleepy, staff, 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 you know. And people go through have different reactions to that situation. You know, some people get really angry. You know, some people begin to beat themselves up. Maybe they're more self-critical. They say, oh, I'll never do this. You know, so everybody else is answering their koans. I can never answer my koans. I knew I was going to wash out at this. You know, everybody begins to look in a mirror and sort of see see how they're stuck, you know. So revealing to fail. Failing teaches us a lot about ourselves. Success, very little, actually. You know, so facing that blankness and saying staff for a long time seems like a fruitless proposition. And if you're used to controlling your every move and being successful, this is very difficult to tolerate, which is why it's so good, right? If you were a good student in school, you know, you want your A and you're not getting your A. Every time you go in to see the teacher, you say, I don't know, I'm just saying staff and nothing is happening. It's like, thank you, see you tomorrow, you know. Next day, nothing is happening. Okay, keep working at it. You know, are you staying staff, you know? As the sesshin, as the 5 days are going by, you know, it's getting closer to the end, you haven't answered your koan, you know, you begin to feel anxious, you begin to feel troubled, you know, I've put in all this time and energy and I haven't answered my koan, you know. You can say, this Zen is crap, you know, this is a fraud, you know, or you could beat yourself up. But, you know, at some point, you just go through a process where it's like this wall between yourself and your unconscious mind opens up, or a door, you could say. And it's as though, you know, it's not like the light comes pouring in or you hear music. But it's like suddenly a part of yourself that is normally closed off or dormant becomes active. This is the activation of your big mind. And, you know, you will suddenly feel, you know, this deep, it's like before you know there's a resolution, you'll begin to feel something emerging. It's like looking at a rug, you know, where there's all this different... shapes, and suddenly you step back and you see a pattern in the carpet, or you think you see a pattern in the carpet. You know, so around day 3 or day 4 of sesshin, people will come in and I'll say, what's happening with your koan? They'll say, oh, nothing. And I'll say, well, just tell me what else is happening besides nothing. And they'll say, well, you know, I'm working on staff, but this keeps coming up. You know, and I'll say, oh, that's interesting. You know, often I'll say, you know, that's the answer. You know, people don't necessarily realize that their big mind is providing them with the insight they're seeking. And when they get that insight, they don't necessarily realize it yet. But this often happens, or they're getting closer, right? Getting closer to the resolution. So you know, this is the process of Zen. And it doesn't really matter what is Buddhist tradition you're working in. This is very much the process of Buddhism in general. You know, it's about learning how to activate this part of our minds that normally remain dormant and unaddressed or unexplored. The irony is, you know, that this is really the most important part of ourselves. You know, modern people live a very successful life, on the whole, you know, and a very controlled life. And so, in some ways, you know, we're really strangers to our true nature. You know, this deeper self, this unconscious mind, in Zen we call it your big mind, is actually who you really are. And so, you know, the process of being stymied and being confused or being powerless, sitting in front of the door of emptiness and waiting for something to happen is really the beginning of transforming your life. You know, when we talk about enlightenment in Zen. You know, one way to think about great enlightenment is this, you know, before your great enlightenment, you're Kurt standing at the door waiting for your big mind to come out. And after your enlightenment, your big mind who basically puts on a Kurt shirt, you know, and goes to work and picks up a Kurt check, right? But when you sit down on your cushion, you realize, oh yeah, Kurt is like a motel room that I live in, but that's not who I am. You know, that's actually, one of the koans actually puts it that way. They don't say hotel room. They say it's like an inn. It's like a room in an inn where you stay for a little while and then you move on. You know, that change is a big change, and it's quite wonderful. So, you know, the process of practicing Zen is learning to discover who you really are by being dumbfounded or stymied or thwarted, and actually by failing a lot. You know, failing and failing. You go in to see the teacher, I'm sorry, that's not it. I'm sorry, not yet, you know, sorry. And you might even come in sometime and I think I've got it, you know. And often it's a very intellectual explanation, and the teacher will say, or I will say, you know, that's a little too intellectual. And then usually people say, I knew that. Because they knew, right? You know, it has to come out of a deeper place in you. And it's, nobody likes sitting facing that blankness in uncertainty and powerlessness. But you know, after you have been there for a while, it's so purifying, right? So purifying. You know, even if you are just sitting here on a Saturday, you know, for one or two sits, or if you come for the whole morning, you know, after you leave here and you go outside, I would bet, you know, sooner or later you're going to have this experience where everything feels different. You know, there's a kind of intimacy with everything around you. It even happens on a Wednesday night or a Monday or a Friday night. You know, you come in, your head is full of thoughts. You've been successfully controlling your life all day long. You sit down on the cushion and you say, okay, now I'm going to have a good sit. And instead, all of these other things happen that aren't a quote-unquote good sit. And maybe you can't free yourself from certain anxious, anxiety-producing thoughts, or, you know, maybe your leg hurts the whole time. And then the bell rings and the sit is over and we serve tea, and you drink the tea and you think, my God, this tea is so good. You know, you'd be amazed at how many people write me or ask. They say, what is that tea? Now, it is true. We often drink, Yen often brings really first-rate tea from Taiwan. So it is very good tea, indeed. But nevertheless, it's not just the tea that makes it so delicious. It's that, you know, you sit facing that blankness in powerlessness, in, you know, helplessness and uncertainty. And even if it's just for 10 minutes, and you get off the cushion and suddenly everything around you can, you know, the tea is so delicious. You know, or you go outside and you realize, oh, you know, you suddenly look at the grass, you know, like you notice the grass, you know. You can see every blade and it's so alive, right? And you're now experiencing the world from a deeper place. You've begun to open up that door between yourself and your big mind, and when you look at the world, it can be so alive, so fresh and clean. You know, long ago, we used to do sesshin at my house. And I remember there were just a few people there. There was Yen and Jaru and Imtiaz and a person named Al and another person named John. I'm trying to remember who else, but we would have like six people at a sesshin. And everybody would sit in the living room. There was no furniture in there. And at the end of the sesshin, people would just go out the front door and get in their cars and drive away. And I remember I was saying goodbye to everybody, and I was standing there, and I heard, it was the most beautiful sound in the world. It sounded like rain, like the sound of, like I could hear the what the koans call the voice of the raindrops. It's like I could hear rain, but I knew there was no rain. It was a clear sky. And it was this sound, I couldn't quite place it, but every time I heard it, it was so beautiful. And I walked around the corner and I saw it was one of the, it was just a sprinkler. But it was so beautiful. That sound, it was like crystalline, and it was just so gorgeous. And it was because the boundary between myself and the world was gone, and I was experiencing everything around me as part of myself. This is very common in the Zen world. How common? Well, Umon held out a staff and said to his assembled monks, "This staff has transformed itself into a dragon and swallowed up the whole universe." See? Where are the mountains, the rivers, and the great world? So, you know, Umon knew about all this. You know, he sat down on the cushion, maybe that morning, and he watched his breath, and he entered samadhi, and he faced emptiness for, we don't know, it doesn't tell us, for a number of hours. And then, you know, he turned and there was his staff. And he felt this experiencing the staff as himself, no boundary between himself and the world. He picked up the staff, and it's like when you're in that state, the staff is everything. It's who you are. It's the universe. This isn't philosophy. It's how you experience the world when you're opening up, when you're opened up. A good friend of mine said after a sesshin, she was walking down the street and she saw somebody approach, and as she looked at the person's face, she felt it was her face. Well, it was her face. You know, it's only our small-minded mental habits that make it feel like it's something separate from ourselves. So, you know, Umon is describing the way the world feels if we do a little zazen, like we did today. And if we learn how to be, we need to fail more often, and we need to be powerless more often if we want to wake up. So please come and fail again, please. And be powerless again, so that you can experience the world, you can experience the mountains, the rivers, and the great world as what they really are, your true self.